welcome to the Global Product Management Talk. This is Cindy Faye Solomon, your host and producer, delighted to be with you today on November 18th, if you're in the United States, on a beautiful Monday morning in the San Francisco Bay Area. I'm here live with Llewellyn Falcon.
Hello.
In the studio at studio132.com with BZ Lewis, and we did start on the half hour a little later than usual because we wanted to be here live, and there's some traffic getting down to Santa Clara from the North Bay, which I just did. Yes. Well, I wanted to provide you with personal Uber, you know, not exactly right. You got a private driver to get you here. So Llewellyn is here in town because his girlfriend is at a Google event. And excellent. And Llewellyn is certainly a developer expert himself, and we have a lot of things to talk about, which we had started talking about in the car. But let me just tell you what we're doing. So the Global Product Management Talk is a discussion of vital issues forwarding product excellence, business process, product management, startups, marketing, innovation, and methodology for passionate product professionals and business owners about what it takes to produce successful products. You can find us at www.blogtalkradio.com/prodmgmttalk. That is our Twitter handle at prodmgmttalk. And you can search for us on the web. We're on iTunes. We're on Stitcher. We're on Blurberry. Pretty much every podcast platform you can search for prodmgmttalk. And you can follow me on Twitter at Cindy F. Solomon. And contact me directly if you'd like to be a speaker, if you'd like to sponsor, if you'd like to showcase your product or your product-related event coming up, contact me at cindy@startupproduct.com. So on Mondays now is this Global Product Management Talk, where I spend an hour with a thought leader discussing what they are passionate about. And on Tuesdays, we're now syndicating the Competitive Intel podcast with Sean Campbell and Scott Weigard of Cascade Insights, and they look at the marketing intelligence and competitive intelligence and give us a business analyst viewpoint of the world and how to increase your market relevance. And on Thursdays or Wednesdays, depending on where you are, Brain Rants from Brainmates Down Under. It's 15 minutes on a topical product management issue from an Australian perspective with our colleagues at Brainmates in Sydney, Australia. So today we are talking with Llewellyn Falco, and he's an instructor for developmentor.com. He's an international speaker and the creator of the open source testing tool approvaltests.com. He spends most of his time programming in Java and C++. He also volunteers creating courseware and teaching kids to program at www.teachingkidsprogramming.org. His blog is at llewellynfalco.blogspot.com. That's LLEWELLYNFALCO.blogspot.com, and that's also his Twitter handle. Llewellyn is the son of a university professor and a game designer. His mother designed Set and Quiddler. His first family computer was a DEC PDP-11 mainframe. It took up a whole house, a whole room, gosh. Which he started programming Fortran on at age 11. So great. And I also, before we talk with Llewellyn, a shout out to our sponsors. Check them out. We're brought to you this week by Startup Product Academy, forwarding product leaders with innovative approaches and experiential learning opportunities. Go to the website at startupproduct.com. Follow them on Twitter at Startup Product. If you're in the San Francisco Bay Area, Startup Product Academy has a pop-up co-working collaboration space on Mondays and Tuesdays at Broadway Studios in San Francisco. Thank you to the AIPMM, the Association of International Product Marketing and Management, promoting worldwide excellence in product management education with training, certification, and professional networking opportunities. Check them out at www.aipmm.com. They have an excellent webinar series on Fridays. You can find them on Twitter at AIPMM, and they also provide the only world-certifying certifications for product managers and product marketing managers and agile product managers. Their trainings are excellent. Sprint.ly. Don't ask how it's going. Watch how it's going with Sprintly. You can find them on the web at Sprint.ly, bringing the entire corporation to the software development process by showing managers and non-engineers a top-level view of what programmers are actually doing. For our listeners, get 10% off your first 3 months at Sprintly using the code PRODMGMTTALK2013. And as I said, we're recording live at Studio132.com with BZ Lewis, our six-time Emmy-winning engineer and excellent musician. And thank you, Blame Sally, for the music. Okay, so Llewellyn says, in theory, you could have legacy code out there that's beautiful, but I'm interested in keeping code working and attainable even if it's old. Code excellence is about discipline, and it's attainable with simple techniques. So if, you know, one of the things we want to talk about is legacy code. So programming code is either going to be rewritten at some point or it's going to die. And legacy code is code you've either inherited or you made, and it's doing something important, so you want to keep it going. It may have been touched by more than 2 to 3 developers, and you want to keep the code from breaking. So besides being a legacy code expert, Llewellyn is one of those people I call a artist when it comes to code. And also, he can talk about code, and he can explain it in human, in non-coder terms, which is very important to me. And one of the things we were talking about on the way here was, you know, how much should product managers know about coding? And, you know, perhaps project managers, technical product owners should know a lot more about coding. But I always want to understand what it is that the people I'm working with are doing, and especially if they're artists. I want to get out of their way and make it as easy as possible for them to do what they love doing, but also for them to produce the end result that we're all after.
And I think this is a unique time in history where things have gotten to the point where they are so complicated that there can be entire areas that we don't see. I mean, like, if you go back, you know, people who baked still had to talk to the people who are actually grinding flour and killing it. And like, you were connected to the process even if you weren't part of it. And it was visible. It was all out there. You know, if you put the car together, you saw in their car. Even if you're driving, you can, like, pop the hood. But now we've gotten to a point where software that you can't even pop the hood. Like, you only see the veneer. You only see the outside. And so we're at a place where there are people who are creating things who have no understanding whatsoever about the thing underneath what they're creating. And that's not to say that they're not experts, right? Because they shouldn't be experts, but they are utterly disconnected.
Well, so that actually calls attention to the whole artisan movement, which you can see here around Berkeley, where people are, you know, growing their own things, and so they know the origins of every ingredient of that bread that they're producing. And my son, he's very involved in the indie music that he wants to produce every piece of it. He wants to be involved in, you know, not only writing the music, but singing it, but the purity of it.
Well, and the connection, right? People want that connection so that they have an idea of, like, where is this coming from, and when is it good, and not just when is it good. I mean, a lot of times the issue with not being connected is that it hurts you, but you don't know why. And that's a very, I mean, kind of scary thing when you're feeling this pain and you have no idea, you feel helpless and scared. And you can even make the situation worse because the few things you do understand are misleading you. You know, I'm not very good with my cars, and I had a situation where a car broke down on me, and I took it into a shop, and I didn't like the mechanic, and he just didn't seem like he was doing good. And he gave me a quote that was like $900, and I was like, oh my God, obviously I'm getting ripped off here because I'm in a position of vulnerability. And then later on, I got it to a dealer where I did trust him, and the bill was $2,000, and I was like, oh my God, that other guy was actually, I mean, I didn't like him, but he was honest, and he was taking care of me, and he wasn't deceiving me. But because I didn't know enough about the car, I was just making it on all these superficial things about the person. And so in the end, I'm getting hurt a lot more because, you know, so often trust is about these superficial things as opposed to actually having a relationship where you know, hey, this person's taking care of me. I can understand what they're saying. And so people, the more disconnected they become, the less they can actually see the code or the less they can read the code. Even if they can't write the code, they get misled a lot. And they go to the people who keep telling them what they want to hear. And then by the time that those lies actually surface, it's so late that you just get flattened.
So, and that's where the managers get a really bad name.
Yeah.
Because...
Well, and the programmer. Everyone suffers in that situation.
Well, everyone gets blamed.
Yeah.
And really, the goal is to make the users happy or to drive revenue.
Usually both. Usually happier people bring more money.
Right. And that's what the issue is, you know, how do we prioritize what's more important here? And, you know, I have a few stories of those decisions being made wrongly.
Well, and I mean, when you talk about priority, and you mentioned that on Tuesday you had the one where they go through the analytics. And that's becoming such an important thing for product managers. We're seeing this come out of Lean Startup where it's like, it's not necessarily data-driven, but it's data-informed. And that can make such an impact. I'll tell you a really short story from our teaching work. We created this whole library in C#. And C# is a really great language, and there's lots of developers out there, and we're talking to them a lot. But it's not good for teaching in schools. And so we hadn't moved to that language for a long time, but we wanted to give something for the people we talked to, the developers, where they didn't have to go to a different language. They could stay where they were familiar. And so we worked with this company, Pluralsight, and we created this free courseware, and we made video. And I took some of the recipes that we hadn't translated, some of the lessons, and I translated one of them. And so here, I'd spent a lot of time putting together this video, and I had another recipe. And we had more time, and we had to start saying, like, do we want to make more videos, or do we want to make more recipes? And there's good arguments on both sides. There's arguments that, like, you know, the videos are good because they help the beginners come in. But, you know, for the kids who are interested, maybe they want to go to the recipes. And we talk about this a long time. But one of the other things we did is we added Google Analytics everywhere. And a lot of people think you can only add Google Analytics on web pages. You can embed them in your software so that you get data from everywhere. And when I brought up the Google Analytics, we looked and we saw, hey, 8,000 people have watched our videos and done the courseware that goes with those videos. And 10 had done the courseware without the video. And all of a sudden that conversation just stopped. And no more were we going to put recipes without videos. Like, and so this data informing your decisions and making your like it will affect your priorities in ways that theoretical conversations can just go on forever. And it's so important, and it's something that's now available to us where we can monitor and record and test these theories that, we think this is true. Let's go find out.
And that's always been the thing for product managers who are supposed to be the people who bring in the data and are aggregating or curating the data to prove the point, but also to communicate the business case as well as the programming consequences.
Yeah, that insight and that vision. And the original vision and the end vision, like they at the high level, they tend to be the same, but in the details, it's so different. And it's those details that get you.
So how What language are you teaching to kids? You said that C++ is not a great...
No. So right now we're teaching with Java. And there's a couple of reasons for it. One very practical reason is that it is what is being used in the AP courses. So that just happens to be very nice. It also works on Mac and PC. That's also very nice because otherwise one school or another is going to get the shaft. So that works really well. But the reason that we like it, and it took us a long time to figure this out, and I'll talk about that process, but it is discoverable. And it's the nature of the language that, like, when you hit a dot, you're multiple choice, but you're shown your multiple choice. Where in a lot of language, so one language that's really interesting for teaching is JavaScript, and it's interesting because you can do it in a website. But what you lose is that even though you're still multiple choice, they're never going to tell you the options. And so that's very frustrating for kids. And frustration is it's the death of learning. Like, struggle is fine, but frustration, it just stops learning, and it stops it really hard. So that was it. One of the things that was interesting is we figured out how to teach not in Java. We learned in a language called Small Basic, which is a horrible language, but a very interesting editor. And this is something that I found with, you know, you talked about this process of artists where things emerge and they come out. And for things to emerge, you need conditions to be happy. You need feedback to be fast. You need the ability to actually do and play with stuff. And then stuff will emerge. Interestingly, once it emerges, you can go to very hard things. So, like, you know, I think of it like a lot of times you'll sketch on paper and you sketch with fluidity and speed, and then you can go and paint in a much more structured way. You let it emerge. You get that sense in something that's very, very quick, very rapid, very, very easy, and then you can go to the hard place. Creating it immediately in the hard place is a very hard thing, and that's one of the reasons why when we're working with products, you know, we do everything we can to get a sense of what we are building as quickly as possible and as real as possible, right? So if, like, I have a song, sing it to me. Don't write it down. Once I hear the melody, I can write it into music much easier. Don't start in the music. If I want to see a scenario, don't give me the requirements are hard. When you look at requirements, like, it's mathematical and analytical, and even very smart people do it wrong all the time. When you talk about a story, like, then you can pull those requirements out of it. I have an example that I use a lot, which is Scrabble. I come from a gaming family, so we always think about games a lot. And if you think about writing down the requirements for Scrabble, I mean, just take a few minutes or a few seconds and think about what are the requirements of Scrabble? And it's hard. You get that kind of blank, there's tiles, there's a board, there's, like, it's fuzzy. But if you say, like, pretend you played Scrabble, you know, last night. So pretend I played last night with my wife. And I can say, oh, well, we got the board, and we drew the tiles out, and we put them in our tray, and then I went for the center word, and I put down star, and because the R was on the thing, I get double points, and then she went underneath it, and or she added a T to make it start. And all of a sudden, like, there's a whole bunch of requirements that go, oh, I can add to words. They have to be connected. You're drawing seven titles. You have a way of displaying your titles. But I can't see her. Like, all these requirements fall out of that. And that's because we tell stories. Like, that's what we do as people. As a kid, you got stories before you could hear and understand
right.
English.
But it's interesting that your stories about how to play. And I immediately went to, what is it that we're playing?
Oh, yeah.
And why are we playing it? I would have told this story, oh, yeah, well, we're playing a game to build words. We're writing words, and we're seeing how we can get them to overlap with each other or intersect with each other. And whoever can do that, and you get more points when you use the, you know, higher level. But I never would have even gone to the board or the letters yet.
And that's another great thing about stories, though. It opens that communication. Whereas requirements, and the complexity of them tends to shut down communication. Stories tend to open up. And I mean, one of the jobs of the project manager is to make this bridge between what the users need and what the people building it are building. Anything you can do that opens that bridge, opens that communication, anything that you can do that makes it so the empathy is stronger, that the engineers really want to help the users. That's so powerful.
So I make a distinction between the project manager and the product manager.
But
you make a good point, though, from an engineer's or from the developer's point of view. To you, they're a manager. You probably care less whether they're managing a finite, time boxed project or whether they're managing the life cycle of the product.
No, actually, I just misspoke. It should always be product. In fact, I don't even like the word project because it's a lie. I mean, when you make a deck, you think, hey, the builders are going to come in and they're going to build the deck. And it's a finite process. But software doesn't end. Like the idea that you are making something and then your programmers are going to go away. And I have small business owners in particular, like, when am I going to be done with these programmers? When can I get rid of that expense? You're never done with your website is never done. It's never done. It's done when your business dies, right? Your product that is automating the inside of your thing, it is constantly, it's like a city. When is a city done? As long as that city is alive, it is growing, it needs new roads, you might have made the roads once, they're going to grow. Your product is continually alive. And so to call it a project is really misleading.
But you do have to break it down, because those small business owners would never use software. You know, I mean, if they thought, I'm going to be paying for this forever, they might, go back, try and do a different business or get really scared.
Scared. I think they get really scared. But it's weird. I mean, when do you get rid of your accountants?
Right.
I mean.
So,
I mean, there's a lot of things that just are ongoing.
Yeah.
And I think that's a really important thing. And when you look at it there, but the other thing you said, break it down. Even though this is going to be going on forever, so I'm not a runner, but I have a friend who runs, and he says when he runs a marathon, he doesn't think about the end. He thinks about the end of the block, right? And it's the same with a product. You don't think about like this big thing. It's all about breaking it into smaller and smaller things. And good project managers, and as a developer, my ability to develop is based on getting small, little, concrete stories. And so when I'm working with good product managers, then they give them to me. And when I'm not, it still hurts me. So now I have to step in to more of that role. So one of the things we volunteer on is a medical record project down in sub-Saharan Africa. And so we went out for a month. And we're working with the programmers. And,
in Africa?
Yeah, in Africa. And the programmer that I'm working with, we're working on a module that does the tuberculosis regimen. Tuberculosis is horrible. You see it on TV, and they're like in the hospital with the person. It is not like that. In fact, it's so bad that they quarantine the people. And so we're creating these the quarantine regimen for like a couple months where they get quarantined. And we're having a very hard time understanding what's going on. And I can tell it, because one of the things I've gotten really good at is understanding when I'm confused. And I think maybe an advantage I get, especially since I move from project to project, is I don't have an expectation of domain knowledge when I come into places. So I get a little extra freedom to say I don't understand this, maybe more than people who are in their day-to-day job have. And so I say that I do not understand this. And I said, maybe we should talk to the doctor. But the doctor's such an important person. Like, I'm not sure if we want to talk to the doctor. But I'm like, no, wait. This is important. We should talk to the doctor. So we go and we talk to the doctor. And the doctor starts explaining this world of TB, which is really complicated. And really glad this guy went to medical school for a long time, because there is no chance we would have gotten this right. But also I can't take it in. It's too much. And so one of the rules I have when you're writing a story is no use of the word or if or maybe or could, you know, like none of these fuzzy words. I want a single path. And so he starts telling me about how it's different from men and women, and I can't take this in. So I'm like, well, just choose one, but he won't choose one because to him this is really important stuff. And it's not that it's not important, it's just more than I can handle. And so eventually I just say, it's a woman. And the story I end up getting is, there's a lady, her name is Mary Perry, she's 40 years old, she weighs 70 kilos, she has not had HIV, she does a tuberculosis test 3 times, 2 of them come back positive, this is the regimen she gets. But that story that I just conveyed to you in a matter of moments took me an hour and a half to get, because there's so many other possibilities that he wanted to give me all of them, and I just wasn't ready. But once we got that, we went back and we programmed for about a day, and that's about all we need to get it set up. And then we went back and we talked to the doctor again, and this time it was just 5 minutes. He's like, oh, well, if it's a man, then it's this. I'm like, okay, great. There's another story. Let me go back. And now my programmer friend and me, we're no longer afraid to bother the doctor, because where before it was hours of his time, now we know it's only going to be a few minutes. And so now we're actually closer to the doctor. We can talk to him and we can get these. And that entire thing comes from taking this very big, complicated subject and breaking it into small little parts. And, you know, so much of being a project manager is breaking it into the small parts and then prioritizing. And so much of project management is that.
Well, you know, it's interesting that you'll go in without having domain knowledge, and that's an issue that we talk about, that product managers, the expectation is that they have domain knowledge before they can get onto a job even. And
that's unfortunate.
Thank you. You know, our take is, look, if we have knowledge of how to manage a product and what are all the key ingredients, or how to think about it, how to analyze and how to get that data, how to ask the right questions, domain knowledge we can get up on pretty quickly. It's getting the seasoning to understand how to manage the product that takes much longer.
And there's skill on how to gain domain knowledge. But the thing that's dangerous is if you think you're bringing in someone who has domain knowledge, then it's even less likely, like if they know the answers already, it's less likely they're going to be open to actually discovering what's there. And so much of this is discovery. You know, it's not, we do not know what we're doing before. And I mean, with houses, if you make a house, making a second house is really expensive. And making the third house is really expensive. But in software, it's just copy. You know, so the reason you build software at all is because you're making something new. And when you're making something new, you don't know what's going. And in fact, thinking that you do hurts you. It closes you from that experience.
But you don't think it would speed if you had some experience in recognizing the patterns that might occur?
Experience in the domain, it doesn't hurt. Unless you think you actually know the whole thing, unless it prevents you from talking to the users. But you need to talk to the users. And one of the things that does actually hurt, and well, okay, yeah. So here's the tricky thing. So I have an open source project, and I created it myself, and so I know it backwards and forward. And I cannot see it with beginner eyes. And so one of the things I do is I remote pair a lot. And one of the things I love about remote pairing is whoever I'm working with, they have a knowledge and a value that I can never have. They can see it with new eyes. They can see the problem, right? And so sometimes, like, the advantage, I'm like, oh, this works in my software, but I realize I haven't documented it so they can see it, or I've given an error message that is just utterly cryptic. You know, so results of doing this is I have error messages now that are like, you're probably making this mistake. Copy this block of code into your software. And people tell me, like, this error message was fantastic. Like, it was so easy to do. And I'm like, yeah, that's not me. That's because I got to work with people who came with the beginner mind. I would have never thought of that on my own because to me it was so obvious. And so, you know, there is that part of when you think you know everything, if you are smarter than your users, you have a harder time designing something for them.
And this is, I experience this in onboarding new people.
Yeah.
You know, this startup product movement is very fluid right now because we're pointing at a problem and discovering what the solution is. So I'm constantly onboarding new people because it's such a learning opportunity, but I think I'm learning more all the time. And then it's almost like an open source project because it totally changes the messaging around what it is we're doing here.
Working with new people is so benefit. I have a saying, I've never met someone so stupid I cannot learn from them. Like, it's so valuable.
Yeah, and it changes your perspective from critiquing to listening, to not having judgment.
And some of the most valuable things I've learned in programming is when I'll be like, so I do a lot of pair programming, so we're sitting at the same computer, and I'll say like, oh, do this, and they'll say, why? And I will start, and I'll be like, yeah, no, you don't need to do it. You know, like, it was my habit. I always do this, and you're right. As soon as you just made me think about that habit, I realized, you know, it was no longer needed. It was just waste that I was used to doing.
Yeah, so I just want to say, so paired programming is when two people are sitting in front of the same console. They don't both have their own computers. They're sharing the keyboard.
Yeah, and when it's done really well, the communication between the two people is really high. So it's not one person typing and one person watching, but it's loud. Like, you can tell pair programming is going well because both brains are engaged. There's communication going on both sides.
So you told me that your colleague uses mob programming.
Oh, yeah. So this is taking it even one step farther. So again, I said, you know, we do a lot of teaching. And there's this technique that's been around in teaching called a randori. A lot of agile words are Japanese. And this comes from a martial art product where one person's in the middle and everyone sort of piles on him. And so it's a little bit gentler in code, but you have one computer usually on a projector, and you have a whole bunch of people in a circle, and you sort of rotate really quickly, usually on 4 or 5 minutes. And the thing about it is it spreads knowledge to the whole group so quickly, and you get this sort of wisdom of crowds that appears as well. And if you think of programming not as you know, typing code into the computer, but as a series of insights, it is so powerful. And in fact, even if again, if we go back to music, one of the things you'll notice with jazz musicians is they don't tend to play solo. And one of the reasons is it's so important to bounce off of the other people. And you see this occur in mob programming. And for them, they were using it as a training technique because, you know, this is one of the things we did a lot was this randori. And then one day, they had a hard problem that nobody knew how to answer. And so they just sat together and did it in that fashion. And it solved so quickly. And they do a process called retrospective, which is you sit down and you say, hey, what went well? Let's do more of it. And so they start doing more of it. And even though it's 5 people in one computer, and you think that would be like so much slower, their productivity has shot through the roof. More than 20 times what it was when they were working individually. And so they just keep doing it. And they get to do really interesting things. Like, for example, with their product owners, they come and sit with the mob during the beginning and end of the story. Right? So they're sitting right there as they're coding in the final part saying, yeah, that's right. That's, you know, this is how I meant, or no, that's not right. And they break it down into small, so they have a product owner sitting with them like every day because they release every day. They release to lots of different factories, so it's different product owners. But that empathy that, you know, there's so much in sitting together. I have a friend who's a university professor, and he writes his papers, and he says, you know who I write my papers with? I write my papers with the people I eat lunch with. You know, so if I'm actually not close enough to eat lunch with you, like, there's a good chance we're not going to write a paper together. And you don't think of, like, that importance of sitting together is just that impactful.
Right. Well, where it's difficult, you know, I find I go into meetings But how I judge what my productivity for the day is what did I get down on paper?
Yeah.
And in meetings, I'm transmitting information or I'm learning. I'm not necessarily
doing.
Producing something that could be, in a project-based, billable hours. And although that meeting was crucial.
Yeah. So it's not as crucial as we think. But the sitting together is crucial. In fact, one of the things that we found is, if you get together, meetings are usually getting together to talk about work. And it's so much more valuable to get together and do work. One of the things we deal with a lot is this sort of, I call it the illusion of agreement, right? And so the thing that's nice about it is everyone's agreeing. And agreeing is usually, a happier state. But it's false agreement, and so it's going to hurt you. And I saw this once in a talk where I had a friend, Ken. He's giving a talk, and he got a question from the audience. And the audience member said, sometimes we have problems breaking stories down. Like, it just doesn't seem to be a way to... And so we have to go a little longer with that. And Ken said, yeah, I have that problem too. Sometimes we do it. We have a bigger story, and we just can't find a way to... And he's like, that's okay. Sometimes that happens. And I knew Ken, and it didn't seem right to me. So I sort of said, well, what do you guys mean by a big story? And both him and the audience member said two. And then Ken said days, and the audience member said months. And all of a sudden, what a big story is completely changed.
Is that an epic?
Well, for him, it was a small story. It was just slightly bigger. And for Ken, it was monstrously big. And, a lot of words we use, like small or okay or real time, like these are, you think there's a standard definition, but it's really based on your experiences. And everyone's experiences are different. So a lot of times we think we are saying the same thing, and we're not. And so when you're talking about work, it's very easy to get this false agreement, where as soon as you get to the details, you get arguments. Or conversely, I've seen with programmers, you get this a lot, where one person will be like, no, that has to be six. Another person's like, no, it's half a dozen. And they will argue for 3 hours about that. And, when you actually look at it, they're like, oh, yeah, that's right. That's the right number. Like, you have to get past that. You have to get past the abstraction and into the details before either you get that agreement that is actually there or that disagreement that is actually there. And either one is valuable. Either one gets you closer to what people actually want.
So we're covering a lot of ground here.
Yes.
So going back to, something I really care about is how much should managers, product managers, know about coding? And to what granular level?
So there's a couple things. One, you need to be able to at least look at code. You should be looking at code. In the same way as if you're doing any product. So like I said, my mother was a card game inventor, and one of the things that you'll do if you hang around card game people is they will rip the cards in half. Because when you rip the card in half, you can tell sort of the layering, and you don't need to know how to layer it together or even what the chemical formulas are. But you'll rip a card ahead and say, oh, this card is layered with three or four sheets, or this has a black layering in the middle, which makes it an actual better card. And it's the same if you're putting together code. Like, you should be looking at your code. You might not understand what it does exactly, but what you will start to get a sense for is this good code or is this horrible code? And, just sit down with your programmer and just say, explain this to me. And if he's going through thousands of lines, right, that's probably a problem. But you'll know it's a problem more when he's going through thousands of lines than when you sit with another programmer, he's going through like 50 lines. And you'll start to get a sense of like, where's the craft underneath? Because that craft is going to hurt you. And what we see happen a lot is the only thing that product managers are valuing is new features. And so that incentivizes you to take those shortcuts. And when you're getting praised because of new features and you don't get praised, in fact, a lot of times you get criticized for taking longer and maybe doing a more job for a longer term, then that incentivizes you to do the quicker features and write bad code. And then everything slows down. And so you're still relatively quicker than the rest of the people on the team. And so unless you look underneath, unless you sit with your programmers and say that, you won't even know that that's an issue. And then there's no chance for you to say, I really want you to clean this up so that it will be, so you can service me better in the future. That this, you know, all these weeds here or all this mess in the kitchen is why my food is coming out bad. Right? You need to sort of look a little under the hood. You don't need to be able to do it yourself. You don't need to be able to write code. You don't need to be able to really understand it by yourself. But you do need to spend time looking at it, spend time understanding it, so that you're not taken advantage of.
Yeah. So does it make sense that the way they do it at Facebook and at Google is they hire people right out of school with computer science degrees, and then they throw them in. They call them product managers. Marissa Meyer put together this program at Google where they actually send them all over the world to the different Google offices, and basically they see what's going on there,
yeah.
Which there's a lot of value in
that.
And we're actually talking about, since product management learning is so experiential, how can we actually get people hands-on experience before it, so then they can become product managers, but embed that into the training?
And Facebook requires you to commit code like
immediately. On the
first day.
Yeah, I've seen people write about that.
And you know, they'll tell you in the interview, you're going to commit code on the first day. And again, it's that connectiveness that occurs. And it's connective in both ways, right? So here in Facebook, they're like, get into the code. And when you go around the world, you get to see so much. I mean, for people who've just traveled outside of the U.S., you notice how much of an impact that makes in their life. There's such value in going to the user and in getting outside of your own world. When I go to companies, again, I will sit down and I'll go to the accounting if I'm automating accounting, and I will sit down and say, show me how to do your job. Just tell me what to do. Let me do it a little bit before I automate. I don't need to know everything. I don't need to handle your entire world. That's more than can do. But let me do this, you know, half hour of what I'm about to automate for you. And after doing that, I care so much more about what I'm about to do. And I'm sympathetic to problems, you know, things that they might not have even known to tell me. But I'm like, you know, this entire step could go away. They're like, really? It can? I'm like, yeah. Or they might not even notice. I'm like, oh, you just did that 4 times. And they're like, I did? That's just how you do it. You know, so that empathy has to go, and to do that, you have to go there. And that means users and product owners coming more towards the programmers, and it means programmers going more towards the users. But there's so much value there. There's so much value. Another thing that's really, really valuable is watching your users where you can't influence them, you know, where you're sort of behind the glass. And then you're going crazy, and you're like, I had a situation where I saw a user install one of my programs once, and then he was doing everything wrong, and I'm yelling at the video screen, which doesn't help anybody. But after that amazingly frustrating experience, I go back, and I really work to make sure it never happens again. When I would speak, I would video myself and watch, and I would cringe. And I used to say, you know, that cringe is the stupid finally leaving. You know, it's like, it's that pain that makes it so I don't do that next time. And you need that. You need to experience that. And that's how you build empathy, and that's how you get better.
So, but, you know, I want to go back to something you mentioned early, which is a dilemma. So the most expensive thing is writing code, is building the product.
From
my point of view, it looks like in the process of building the product, if we could define it accurately, if we could identify the market, the users, the partners, the strategy, and the last thing we do is commit code, it seems like we'd be able to be more...
Okay, so that's a complicated statement, so I'm going to have to unpack pieces of it. First of all, building the wrong thing is very expensive.
Yes, yes.
Right? And so that's, earlier where I said, you know, get something out there and put data on it and make little experiments that validate that you're building the right thing. That's utterly important because we are wrong about so much. Even if we have a generally overall picture that's right, if you are missing little pieces of it, it really goes wrong. So get those things and get data against them. Get them in the hands of users. Watch your users. A lot of times users, what they do and what they say are not in line.
Always.
So watching what they do is so much more valuable. There's a saying in Brazil that everyone says that they read The Economist magazine, but OK Magazine is on their coffee table.
Right.
You know,
right.
It's like,
People Magazine.
Yeah, so it's what you do is so important. So that's important, to build the right thing. But then in terms of the actual cost of your project, most of that comes from maintenance, right? People will talk about, like, it took me so long to fix this bug. That's almost always a lie. What is accurate is it took me so long to find the bug. Usually the bug you fix is like one line of code. You do it in a matter of seconds, but it's one line of code in 20,000 lines of code and you have no idea. And you are searching for hours to figure out what, and then when it's there, you're just like, oh, that should have been, you know, a lot of times it's, that was one, but it should have been zero, or that was 13, but it should have been 14. I was off by one error. It's 8 hours to fix that. It's 8 hours to find that. And with code, maintenance is easily 90% of your product. And because you're building features during that maintenance, even though they've ground to a halt, it's so expensive. And you will look around, you know, notice when you go to the airport next time, or you're renting a car, or you're checking out at your store, notice if you see a DOS prompt on there. Why are they still on DOS?
Right.
It's because they can't change. They can't upgrade these systems. They are still around. Banking systems.
So DOS goes back 30 years. Does it go back more than 30 years? So that was before the World Wide Web.
Yeah.
How you interacted, and before Windows.
Yep.
How you interacted with your computer was through a DOS line where you had to put in code.
And on systems that are even less visible, you see COBOL.
And that's
where
you see in old movies, as a matter of fact.
Yeah, yeah. And sadly, you will still see it today because they don't know how to upgrade those systems. They're very complicated. And so they still have programmers working on them because you have to, because stuff goes wrong. And when it does, your business stops. But that maintenance is so expensive. And things that should have taken only a few days can take months when maintenance turns this way. And because of that, that's what you're really paying. Even though you see like a feature pop up once in a while and you think that's what I'm paying for, and that's the only thing you can sell to a manager, so they're going to say, well, this feature is going to take us 3 months. And what they're not telling you is that 90% of that is tax we are paying because it's just so hard to work with this system.
So what, you know, people who know how to program in those languages are getting older.
And dying.
Yeah. So where are they I meet a lot of seasoned programmers here in the Valley who are frustrated because they can't get jobs, or they've been downsized or outsourced, or where should they be going to find those legacy code that needs them?
There's so many places. And one of the things that is actually really good for us is that there are a lot of jobs for programmers. There's more jobs for programmers than there are programmers. So we, even when though we have individual people who struggle from time to time, overall we're a very lucky industry. But
seasoned people have a really hard time getting jobs because they're perceived as, well, they need more money, and they're perceived as not being agile thinkers.
Just to call a spade
waterfall.
A spade. There's a lot of ageism out there.
There's a lot of ageism.
So, you know, you look at someone who is, you know, topping 50 and 60, and you're dealing with prejudice outright, prejudice that's occurring. The other thing is these jobs are usually not the sexy jobs.
Right.
So there's a lot of sort of opting out that occurs. And then the other thing is because they're not the sexy jobs, a lot of times they're not given the importance and importance comes in all sorts of things. It comes in money. It comes in, like, what your office looks like, what kind of equipment you get to work out, what kind of respect you get. And that can happen a lot, where it's like these projects, even though they're in place, we don't want them to change much, and they're not popular. And so much, I mean, funny story, clearinghouse software only works during banking hours, even though it's computers. They will not work on the weekends, and they will not work at night. And that's because of paradigms that came out, you know, ages ago, and software that's just hard to change. And so one of the things that's unfortunate is a lot of the people who are talented and good at solving, because these are very hard problems. Once it gets big, once there's a lot of ugly old code, these become really hard problems. I use a visualization technique, which is 20,000 lines of code is about the last book of the Harry Potter series. So if you can look at that code, you say, that's 20,000 lines of code. And when someone tells you, I have 2 million lines of code, right, that's 100 Harry Potter books sitting there in not nearly as nice to read prose. And if you think you're going to read all of that and understand it and then make a change, I mean, it is a mountain of work. And a lot of these projects are somewhere between, you know, 500,000 and 1 or 2 million lines of code. And it's really, really tough stuff. So a lot of people sort of say, oh, let's go do something funner or more sexy. For me, I happen to have a real love of jigsaw puzzles. And I think that just sort of, you know, sometimes a jigsaw puzzle, if you think about it, is just a crazy thing. You have a picture that is complete, and now you're going to cut it into pieces and throw it out for fun. Like, and so I do have a sort of weird aspect of my personality that just likes the challenge. But also there's something beautiful in, you know, when the jigsaw puzzle comes together, it's something nice, or it's like, hey, look what I did. And there's something beautiful about that in legacy code too, where you're like, this used to be ugly and now look at it, it's beautiful. And it is really satisfying. As it cleans up, there's a lot of satisfaction for that.
Well, I must say this has been a very satisfying discussion with you, Llewellyn. The hour has flown by very quickly. And, we didn't even, you know, touch.
So much more to talk about.
Yeah, there's so much more to talk about, because everything that you were saying, I'd love to you know, we didn't even get into the techniques, the simple techniques for, you know, how to even approach legacy code. That's a whole issue that about people in programming having long careers and people who are looking to get in that are just want to work in programming, don't care, you know, they want to feed their kids.
Yeah.
You know, I met a lot of them at Silicon Valley Code Camp, where we first met, by the way.
I will say this. I know a lot of programmers who are great programmers who came to it late in life. So even though, like, so many of the programmers are young kids, it is not the case that if you weren't born with a computer in your hand, you cannot be a programmer. Overall, the overwhelming thing in our industry is not brilliance. It's not analytics. It's discipline.
Ah.
The programmers who are disciplined are the ones who – they are continually learning, and they are getting better, and they are producing better code. So, you know, don't let the fact that you're not there stop you. Like, there is nothing that makes it have to be early. There's nothing. Just stick with it. Keep learning. Keep being disciplined. Discipline is so important, but if you do that, it will come.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much for coming up here from Santa Clara and from Google territory. This is Cindy Faye Solomon. I've been talking with Llewellyn Falco, who is the co-founder of TeachingKidsProgramming.com. He's a creator of ApprovalTest.com, and he's a legacy code expert. It's been an honor having you come in and joining us in the studio. Tune in on a regular basis. We'll just go to Blog Talk Radio at www.blogtalkradio.com/PRODMGMTTALK and follow us there, and you'll get pinged with every new episode coming up. Later this week, you'll hear from Competitive Intel, a quickie on marketing and competitive insights and some data analytics, and Brain Rants from Brainmates Down Under. I want to thank again our sponsors. Check them out at AIPMM, the Association International Product Marketing and Management, at Sprintly, sprint.ly. Don't ask how it's going. See how it's going using Sprintly. If you're trying to manage programming in a business atmosphere, Sprintly is definitely an excellent tool to have. Thank you to Studio 132, BZ Lewis. Thank you to Blame Sally, and have a great week.
Lost to a thief on a driveway.